to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. Flooding is a threat to infrastructure in many places. Airports are at particular risk in some locations because they are flat by design and commonly have been located in coastal or riverine settings. Airports in the New York metropolitan area are especially vulnerable because of their exposure to both rising sea level and severe storms. To explore the risks and protective actions for airports in New York, we're talking with Richard Barone, who's Vice President for Transportation of the Regional Plan Association. Richard has been studying the flood risks to these facilities. First of all, Richard, could you tell us something about the Regional Plan Association, for those who don't know?
Yeah, RPA has been around for over 95 years. We're America's first regional planning organization. Our first plan came out in 1929, about a couple of days before the stock market crash, the Depression began, really created by the private sector along with the former officials to kind of think about the metropolitan area. One of the big issues we have in New York is the fact that our metropolitan area is made up of parts of Connecticut, New York State, and New Jersey, and it's very fragmented. So the idea was to kind of put all this together and actually think about it as it's developed, meaning that, like, reality is we really do function as one collective metro area, but we don't actually plan that way. So RPA has been doing this for about 100 years now.
And not as a governmental organization?
No, we're an NGO. Basically, we're a think tank that also is an advocacy organization. So once we come up with our ideas and our plans, we then go out there and work with government and push government and political leaders to enact them.
Tell us what happened to the airports in New York during the two hurricanes that a lot of us remember, Irene in 2011 and Sandy in 2012.
Yeah, I mean, Sandy was the big one when it came to the airports. And specifically, they were taken out of service. They were flooded, damaged the airfields, flooded the airfields. But they were put back in service relatively quickly because it was a storm surge event. The water just came in. They had to be closed during that. Aircraft were removed before the storm. But once the water receded, they were able to basically bring them back online pretty quickly. There was infrastructure damage, runway lighting, some other issues that cropped up. But they were pretty resilient, actually, for Sandy. Compared to some other infrastructure that we have in the region, like our subway tunnels and whatnot, the airports weathered it pretty well.
Is this a new phenomenon, or is it just a repeat of something you've experienced before?
Well, Sandy was really one of the worst storms we ever had in New York, so it was very severe. Our infrastructure was hammered, to say the least. A lot of our subway system, our rail tunnels and whatnot, were severely damaged. We're still rebuilding them today, and we will be for a while, because one of the big issues in New York was the saltwater infiltration and what that did to equipment, what it did to concrete. It just really tremendous amount of damage. We've been spending a lot of money and resources to not only repair that damage, to also harden the infrastructure so that when it does happen again, it likely will happen again as we see more and more extreme weather, we're better prepared to deal with it. But when it comes to the airports, one thing I would maybe pivot to a little bit is the idea of sea level rise, which is something that actually does threaten the airports even more so than storm surge.
The airports that I'm familiar with in your area are LaGuardia, which used to be a seaplane base and it's right on the water, but also JFK, Newark, and Teterboro. Are all of these at risk?
Yeah, in different levels. The one that's at greatest risk in the near term is Teterboro Airport, which is located in the Meadowlands. In our plan, we actually envision closing Teterboro in the next 30 years or so as the water starts rising in the Meadowlands and rethinking the Meadowlands as a national park. And the Meadowlands is this area in New Jersey that is, you know, low-lying marshland wetlands, actually, where several rivers come into it as well. And, you know, there's a lot of industry there. There's a lot of industrial uses there. There's some recreational uses, some residential, but also an airport. And over time, this area is going to flood, and it's going to get wetter. So we do think Teterboro, in the long run, is probably going to disappear as an airfield, which means that the other airports need to do more. We do think Newark is actually able to be protected, and so will the port need to be protected as well. But Newark's in a better position. JFK is actually in the best right now as far as its elevation. It's the furthest above sea level, and it will need to be probably hardened for storm surges. As the sea level rises, they're going to be worse. But nevertheless, the airfield is in best shape. And LaGuardia, while probably pretty much ranked after Teterboro as being vulnerable, as you mentioned, it was a seaplane airport. LaGuardia does have a perimeter defense that the Port Authority has constructed to actually protect it up to 4 to 5 feet of sea level rise. So LaGuardia is, again, not threatened in the near term or in the next 50 years or so. In the longer term, when we get to 6 feet sea level rise, LaGuardia would be threatened by constant flooding. And that's the issue. I mean, sea level rise is different than storm surge is the fact because it's something that's constant. Once the seas rise to those new levels, we're going to deal with the facilities being flooded throughout the day. And that's a huge problem. Obviously, they won't be able to operate.
You have more time to prepare for that. But my understanding is storm surges, and particularly these nor'easters, are quite common in your part of the country.
They are. I mean, we haven't experienced a big one this year. We've had several years, obviously, since Sandy occurred. But we do think that they're not going to happen every 100 years. They're likely to happen more frequent than that. But like I mentioned earlier, the storm surge events, if the infrastructure will take the hit when the water comes in and then recedes relatively quickly, or can be pumped out quickly, that's different than when the water actually rises and stays at the new elevation, which will be much more of an issue for us in the long term. So we are very much, in the fourth plan, we're very much focused on the need to harden infrastructure, which is something we're already doing, and we have been doing since Sandy. We've been raising critical infrastructure as far as buildings and even in our airports, the LaGuardia Airport redesign that's underway now. The critical systems are being raised, so if the LaGuardia was to flood, they wouldn't be damaged. So there's things that we're doing to deal with the surge issue. The harder one to deal with in the long run is the sea level rise.
The perimeter defense that you described at LaGuardia, how recently was that put in?
It's been in probably for decades at this point. And the Port Authority is working on further shoring it up. There's a couple little gaps in it that they're working to fill. So when it comes to LaGuardia, they have tried to prepare it more for this because they obviously know it's very vulnerable based on its location. Teterboro is a very hard one to protect just because it's surrounded by either communities or other facilities, and you have to kind of almost build a wall, and even then the water can percolate through the ground. So Teterboro is a more difficult situation to deal with than LaGuardia. And we do think, again, surprisingly so, JFK is in a really good shape when it comes to sea level rise. And Newark is blocked, as you know. You have the port in front of it. And then after that, you have I-95, and you have Newark Airport. All three of these things are critical infrastructure, so we need to protect all that infrastructure in the long run because we can't move it all.
So it's not just the airport. You've got all that other infrastructure to deal with.
We have I-95. You know, it's a major, major corridor in the Northeast for goods movement and intercity travel. It's a critical roadway, and our port is second largest port in the nation behind the ports in California.
Yeah, so that is a critical resource. My recollection is the last time I went through LaGuardia that I could see the perimeter defense, and it looked like there was a fairly large-scale system of pipes, and I assume that's for pumping out water.
Yeah, they have pumps, and my understanding is they're also strengthening that infrastructure as well because there is a low point in the airport where the water does pool when it comes in, but they are trying to address all those issues at LaGuardia. We were very clear in our report that those issues need to be addressed because we do feel 3 feet is coming. This seems like a long time away, but it could be the 2050s to 2080s is when we feel that's going to be actually starting to happen here because we do believe, I think most do, that we're in a period of adaption. We need to adapt versus we're not going to probably stop it at this point. But nevertheless, when we get to 6 feet, which again is somewhere in the 2100s, the airport protection needs to be rethought at that airport because it won't be sufficient.
The operative agency, if I recall, is the New York-New Jersey Port Authority. Are they taking this seriously?
Yes, yes, they really are. They have a person on staff who's just in charge of thinking about all these things as far as the resiliency of their infrastructure and whatnot. And they do have a very, I would say, sophisticated way of thinking about what to make resilient and what not to based upon the life cycle of the infrastructure. If sea level rise is anticipated to happen 3 feet in the next 50 years, if a piece of infrastructure only lasts about 15, they're not going to worry about hardening that infrastructure. But if it lasts 100 years, they'll make sure that the investment's made to make sure that infrastructure can actually withstand sea level rise or be resilient.
Are they taking any special action to finance these investments?
I don't know if they really are at this point. They might be. I know the MTA did this with their catastrophe bonds that they released, you know, they actually issued, which helped pay for some of the loss to the operations as far as their inability to actually raise revenue when the system was out. But I'm not sure what the Port Authority is doing specifically as far as additional funds. I mean, again, the Port Authority is self-sufficient, so they raise their revenues through all the fees and their facilities and the tolls that they collect on the bridges and tunnels and landing fees at the airports and all that. So they essentially fund themselves.
In the work that you did you look at the flooding risk at other airports around the country or around the world?
We use an example of what, for example, Singapore is doing when it comes to preparing its airports for sea level rise. We use that as a case study, but we didn't really do a comprehensive review of what places are at risk and what places aren't. I think in many cases you see almost large cities were built next to major waterways or near the ocean because of shipping, right? And that's the historical development of cities, so a lot of places are vulnerable to this. Some places have taken more dramatic steps to deal with it. In London, they have the Thames Barrier, for instance, to help deal with flooding that occurred in London. Other cities are deciding to take a greener route instead of building a barrier to basically adjust their landscape to deal with sea level rise. So, or let the water in, as they say in some cases, or storm surge to let the water in. And then instead of trying to prevent the water from coming in, there's different strategies for dealing with this. Like I said, there's the hard strategy with a wall or barrier, as they call it. And then there's the strategy of saying, well, let the water come in, flood. Then when it, once it recedes, the infrastructure, the facility is designed to actually take that, and it comes back online almost immediately or can be repaired very easily. Again, it depends on, I guess, the level of vulnerability and how much critical infrastructure is all massed in one place.
Speaking from the perspective of an NGO, do you feel that you have a kind of freer platform to explore these kinds of issues and bring them to light in the public eye?
That's our role. I mean, our role is to be independent, to think about things and promote things that might not always be popular as well, and not to be beholden to a specific constituency, except for, honestly, trying to do the best we can to improve things for the public at large. So that's our responsibility, and we take it very seriously. We've been around, like I said, for almost 100 years, so we have a history, and we have our credibility. We do really try to spend a lot of time looking at the issues, exploring them, pulling the facts together, doing the analysis. We actually very much so collaborate with these various government actors as well. Many of them, their role is to serve the public too, and they're doing a very good job, and they're trying their best to come up with the best solutions. So we work with the agencies as well and run our ideas by them and collaborate with them in the sense of basically having a dialogue with them. Many times we don't agree, but it is our role to get this implemented. So we try to make sure that we cover all the bases and be as professionals.
The way you describe it, it sounds like it's a collaborative relationship, not an adversarial relationship.
It's mostly that way. There are things seriously we disagree with, and sometimes it can become very adversarial. It goes both ways. It's hot and cold, depending on what we're working on, because there are certain things that are very much straightforward that there's huge agreement on, and some things that are less popular and potentially, like one of the things we're looking at right now, for example, is why things cost so much and take so long to get built in New York City. And that's something that obviously the folks in some of the agencies are more sensitive about because they do try their best, but there's a lot of external factors that contribute to why things are so expensive. And some things obviously within the organizations themselves that lead to it. And so we're then trying to be objective and we point these things out and people aren't always happy to hear that. Not everybody likes criticism. But we do both. At the same time, if we're working on the airport stuff, for example, looking at the sea level rise stuff, we do our analysis, come to our conclusions, then we say, okay, Port Authority, this is what we find. Do you agree or do you not agree? And if they don't agree, then we have a discussion about it. Will then prove to us why you think this is wrong or vice versa. So we have those discussions as well. We like to think that we try to challenge them in many ways and push them to do more and to think bigger.
It's an important role that you play, and I am familiar with the organization. We'll make sure we have a link to your website on our website so other people can get to know the Regional Plan Association and then the voice that you provide for infrastructure. Richard, I really appreciate your spending the time with us today to tell us about this situation, which I think is shared in many places around the world and certainly in the United States. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.